The best advice a supervillain ever gave. Follow the Green Cross Code. By A.J. Hall. Narrated by Rhea 314. Fandom, the King, Eternal Monarch. There is nothing suspicious about the death. Nothing whatsoever. It's 2014. CCTV blankets Seoul. The eyewitness testimony only reinforces what the footage shows. A street kid, loitering on the corner, playing with a yo-yo at the time of the incident, saw everything. He seems not at all disconcerted to be the focus of so much police attention. He gives his account in a high, childish voice, without irrelevancies or digressions. First came the noise, like a big explosion, very loud, so very loud. The listeners nod. CCTV has caught that too. A rectangle of polished stone cladding, 2 meters by 3, imperfectly secured below the hook of a crane on the construction site on the far side of the road, slipped out of control and crashed 30 meters to the ground, in the process shearing the entire right side off a limousine, which has just discharged its passenger, a senior executive on his way to an emergency board meeting. Then suing investigation into corner-cutting and corrupt practices in the construction industry will in due course bring down one minor conglomerate and put 2 junior government ministers behind bars. He was crossing the road when the crash came, walking towards me, the construction site at his back. He spun around at the crash, and that was when the fried chicken delivery scooter came around the corner. He was standing still right in the middle of the road. No one could have avoided hitting him. The driver of the scooter, 17 and trembling, confirms the street kid's account. The rookie team member, on her first day on active duty after police college, is ordered to get him a white coffee with extra sugar. On her own initiative, she adds a packet of green grape candy. He is too shocky to say thank you, but his color improves. Chief Park signs off the preliminary paperwork, gives the happy sigh of a man who foresees a large bowl of oxney soup in his immediate future, and orders the rookie and the next most junior member of his team to start going through the dead man's personal effects. Sometime soon, some poor woman in this city will have the worst day of her life. The least we can do for her is to cut short the worrying and give her certainty. Get him ID'd, and then, Cadet Jeong, you can come with me to break the news to the family. It's one of the nastiest parts of the job, and it never gets easier, so the sooner you get the hang of it, the better. And at least this one's all in one piece, and hasn't been left sealed in an apartment for 3 weeks in July, so text me when you have the address. That is when a straightforward case becomes something else entirely. Che boy, Lieutenant Wu observes knowledgeably. That's a 2 million won overcoat. More, probably. Real vicuña. Tail knits her brows. But why no labels? They've all been taken off. I don't mean just from the coat, from everything, even the underwear. Admittedly, she's not in the habit of seeing the rich in their underclothes, except for that one time at Nadi's when one of Nadi's brother's schoolmates had decided to demonstrate just how much of a head for soju he lacks. Nadi accepted she's not in the habit of mingling with the rich at all. Still, from glimpses at school and college, and more especially from TV shows and gossip items, her impression is that they are all about the designer labels. Maybe that's just the young ones. The casualty looks to be in his late 40s, but that could be deceptive. Money may not buy happiness, but it certainly comes in handy when financing a good skincare regime, top-flight dentistry, and cosmetic surgery. The casualty has definitely had the double eyelid procedure. The autopsy may reveal other discreet work. He could be anything up to 10 years older than her initial guess. She disconcerts herself, momentarily, by her detachment. She has caught the sidelong glances from the other team members, and the muttered comments about her first dead body on her very first day. She knows they have been expecting her to turn dizzy or vomit. She half expected it herself. Instead, duty. To the dead. To the unknown woman waiting at home for a man who would never return. To the truth. And burning, passionate curiosity has carried her through. It turns out she has been right all along. This is the job she was born to do. Lieutenant Wu shrugs. Pocket contents. Item 1. A wallet. High-quality pigskin, no maker stamp or logo. Wallet contains some 400,000 won in high-denomination notes and 2 cards prepaid. Item 2. A set of keys, apparently for an apartment. Street door, apartment door, deadlock. No indication of address. Plain steel key ring, no fob. Item 3. A large white handkerchief. Cotton, high thread count, hand-rolled hem, no embroidery. Item 4. A 2G phone. Item 5. A roll of analog photographic film in a standard plastic canister.
We'll have to get that developed, and the phone unlocked. With luck, those two should get us somewhere.
Okay. Final item. The victim's umbrella. The umbrella is rather heavier than Tail expects. There is something wrong about its balance. She has trained as a fighter since she could walk. She knows all about balance. Intrigued, she fiddles with it, finds a small button recessed at the base of the handle, and presses it to see what happens next. And finds herself holding a sword. The hell? Lieutenant Wu gapes for a moment, then reaches for his phone.
Chief Park, I think you should come over here as soon as convenient. We may have a situation.
They dub him the Umbrella Man, of course. Forensic examination of the concealed sword shows very faint traces of blood on the blade, up where the steel joins the handle, where even the most fastidious cleaning has failed to eradicate them. They extract DNA, with considerable care. The resulting sequence is partial and broken nonetheless. It is not the casualties. They try, and fail, to match it with any relevant cold cases. The umbrella contains yet more secrets. X-raying its handle. Tail's hunch. Balance once more. Reveals an artifact hidden inside. Half a bamboo flute, ancient with black varnish. They summon an expert from the history faculty at the National University. He has assisted them before on matters involving grave robbing and the cross-border trade in stolen antiques. He blenches and witters about historical lacquering techniques, the 7th to 8th century CE, and carbon dating. Tail almost fancies she can hear the artifact crying in pain. And who would blame it, since it's already been brutally truncated and thrust into the interior of an umbrella's handle? Her grip on it closes protectively. Hours later, she will find beads of dried blood on the pad of her thumb, where splinters from its cut end have pierced the skin, and scold the artifact roundly for its ingratitude before locking it back in the evidence closet. "I am afraid I cannot let you do that. This item is material evidence in an ongoing case of suspicious life." The professor smirks.
"Suspicious death, surely, officer."
"No, professor, there was nothing suspicious about the death. Nothing whatsoever. But I cannot release this object into your custody until we've finished our investigation. Ascertaining the truth comes before the practice of history, every time." He never does get it. The phone is a burner. It's never been used. There are no numbers stored in it. The roll of film, when developed, generates over a dozen prints of a graduation ceremony, a vast outdoors event held within something resembling a sports stadium. It takes a little online effort to identify the location as Stanford University, Palo Alto, California, USA. The prints include close-ups of an older man, gray-haired, twinkling, and professorial, dining on a restaurant terrace with a striking young woman in a cap and gown of a newly minted Bachelor of Sciences. His doting smile conveys "favorite grandchild" and "summa cum laude" as clearly as if the snaps were subtitled. The final one, where he is caught on camera handing the graduate the keys to a brand new Jaguar convertible, merely underlines the point. Copies are duly sent to Stanford with an explanation of the circumstances. Stanford raises
numerous objections to providing any information whatsoever. After much pressing, the university regretfully confirms it has no record of the student in question. Also, there are certain irregularities and inconsistencies about the pictured ceremony. Might the photos perhaps be stills from a film or a TV production rather than a genuine Stanford commencement? Jaguar Land Rover requests information as to the source of the photograph to pass to their intellectual property council. They note no such model exists or has ever existed. At the next year's Frankfurt Motor Show, the new JLR Chasis design causes considerable excitement in the motoring press. Whatever the cop shows imply, space in mortuary freezers is at a premium. They hold on to the body for 3 months. And then, for another 30 days, because Chief Park wants to be sure the kindly-faced old man from the graduation photographs will have a whole body returned to him for burial, if the Stanford lead comes up trumps. Once Stanford returns a dusty answer, not even Chief Park can keep the Umbrella Man's corpse any longer. It's cremated at the expense of the state. In default of any other address, his ashes are returned to Squad 3, National Police Agency, Seoul. They arrive in a busy season. No one gets around to doing anything about the urn for ages. Chief Park mutters it's very irregular, until, who has recently reviewed the rulebook for her police examinations, is pretty certain it's specifically forbidden. But somehow or other, the Umbrella Man's ashes end up in the evidence closet, in the same box as the rest of his belongings. Squad 3, faintly embarrassed, decides to make virtue out of necessity. Thenceforth, on their first day on the team, rookies are formally introduced to the urn and required to pour it a remembrance offering of soju. He is, Squad 3 argues, their Umbrella Man, after all. It is 2019. Antale is no longer the second or even third most junior member of Squad 3. When she looks back at her early days on the team, her past self seems almost comically naive. Granted, she has not yet seen attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion, nor, for that matter, sea beams glittering in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. However, by now people with delusions of grandeur are a regular occurrence in Tao's life. On the whole, those who think they are royalty are less of a pain than the ones who think they're gods. Though Tail is prepared to make an exception for those who drag innocent horses into their psychotic play-acting. The man, who refuses to give his name, whom Tail is nicknamed Ketong, is infuriatingly loquacious on every other topic. Halfway through an exposition on Einstein, one word in 5 of which she hears and one word in 20 of which she thinks bears some tenuous relationship to scientific fact, she takes the opportunity presented by his ever-open mouth to swab his inside cheek for a DNA sample. He assures her, loftily, that it is useless. He has no family in the Republic of Korea, so the DNA check will come up as empty as the fingerprint check has already done. She hates to think so, but suspects it may well do at that. A week passes, and then, when she's just about to give up for the day on her frustrating search of junkyards for a weapon which may never have existed, or, if it ever did, is probably now at the bottom of a river, Kyungran calls. There's something in Ran's voice which Tae-il has never heard before. She puts the flashing lights on her car's roof as she races towards the station. Kyungran is waiting for her at the top of the steps, in front of the glass double doors, holding out the DNA report in hands which shake. Tail rings the fancy hotel where Ketong is staying and orders him not to move an inch until she arrives. She uses the tone she reserves for junior members of her Taekwondo class when they're acting out. From the frozen silence on the other end of the line, she gathers no one has ever come within 200 kilometers of using a tone like that on him in his life. She smiles. He'll stay put. They always do. The upper regions of Police HQ are dark, apart from the prisoners in the holding cells, the staff on the front desk, and the security detail. She must be the only person in the building. She has never been conscious of this before, But the fact that the evidence closet contains the ashes of a dead man strikes cold down the back of her neck. She is Teo, the woman who believes the world is flat. She has no use for ghosts. She unlocks the evidence closet, takes out the box, and extracts the mortuary photographs of the Umbrella Man. Mindful of Chief Park's instructions, the least upsetting ones are at the top of the deck. As an afterthought, she adds the graduation snaps. She is about to return the box to the closet when the sudden high wailing sound almost brings on a migraine. Even when the supercilious professor had been threatening to carbon date it, the artifact had never sounded like this. But she knows it is calling, nonetheless. She reaches out her hand and strokes it as she might a stray cat. She is Teo, the woman who believes the world is flat. She has no use for ghosts, but her philosophy is wide enough to encompass them, nonetheless. So are you after an outing or what? Okay. You've been shut in there a good long time, I know. Come with me, then. But I warn you, this isn't a pleasure trip. She drops the artifact into her shoulder bag, along with the photographs and the DNA report. Teo uses her screamers on the way to Ketong's hotel. It helps shorten the journey, but she has too much time to think all the same. She has done this too many times, and it never gets easier. The worst ones are children, of course, or parents, siblings. Given the relative ages and the odds, the most likely relationship in this case is first cousins. First cousins who, by definition, cannot have seen each other for at least 5 years. Bad news, of course, but hardly likely to be world-shattering. Doesn't that rather depend on who else he has in his world? She runs through all the times she's seen the stranger with royal delusions. From the moment he got down from his horse and hugged her in the middle of Kwangamun Plaza, she had, at the time, dismissed him as an opportunistic creep. But it strikes her now that his grip on her upper body had been more desperate than suggestive. Like a child clinging to one familiar thing in a universe suddenly turned alien. She recalls his insistence on always having his food tasted before he eats it, and for the first time puts that together with the image of a man with a concealed blade in his umbrella. They may not be royalty, but this is not a normal family. This family swims in peril like carp in water. She shows her police badge at the hotel reception desk and asks them to let the guests know she is on her way up. The tone she uses clues them in immediately. Grave-faced, they escort her to the lift. He answers the door himself. Fortunately, Eunsop must have taken himself off for the evening. Whatever he reads in her face cuts short his normal impulse to babble. Only when they are sitting down, facing each other across an infinity of expensive rug, does she start to speak. I know you're a mathematician, so I don't have to explain probability to you. When we carry out DNA tests, we compare the results with other samples we have on file. Where that produces a positive match with another sample, the overwhelming probability is that those two people are related. The CM number, just how much DNA the two people in question share, gives us a steer on how closely they're related. The ranges are quite wide, so it's not entirely precise, but it's a starting point.
You've found a match with me.
I have. She picks her next words carefully, but there is no point in raising false hopes only to dash them. That is, we've found a match in our unidentified persons files. I'm afraid your relative died a few years ago. We've been trying to find out who he is, too.
How did he die?
It occurs to her that this is not the question she had expected. It also occurs to her that he is trying to put off the moment when he has to ask that question. In a street accident. There was nothing suspicious about the death, nothing whatsoever. It was my first day on the job, so I remember everything quite clearly. I can show you the reports later if you like, but first, I have some photographs here, and I'd be grateful if you could let me know if you can identify the person in them. And if so, tell me his name. She sees him swallow, sees his knuckles go white where he clasps his knees. Her hand, reaching into her shoulder bag, brushes against warm wood and ancient lacquer. Her fingers close around the artifact. Actually, we found this among his things after the accident. We wondered if it might be a family heirloom. Perhaps you recognize it. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this Podfix post. Thank you for listening, and happy ITPE the 24th key. Hopefully you've enjoyed this.